Hey there, Bio 231 lecture class. Welcome to class. And this is your last lecture before the test. I'm going to adjust the microphone a little bit. Oh, I got to turn it on. Sorry. Okay, check, check, check. Check, check, check. Sounds good. All right, let's take a look at the schedule. Probably nobody needs to look at the schedule, but let's go ahead and look at it anyway. So what is today? Today is the 18th. Indeed it is. So we're going to finish up diversification system today, talk about the female reproductive system. And the afternoon class, they'll get their last practicum and a quiz today. So practicum first and then a quiz out in the hall when you're done with the practicum. And then you're free to go. There's no lab today. All right, and then that means our next meeting on Wednesday, May 20th, there's no lecture, only a lecture exam, and there's also a practicum for the Wednesday labs. And last time I'd mentioned to the Wednesday labs, anybody have a Wednesday morning lab in here? Anybody? Raise your hand. Couple people. Okay, maybe not everybody. But I know in lab, I said we were going to start the practicum at 9 o'clock, and if everybody's there earlier, I'll start the practicum earlier because as soon as we're done with the practicum, I'm going to make sure it's set up for the next class. Then I'm going to come down here and open the door up as long as there's not another class in here, but I don't think there is another class. So that means that I might be here a little bit before 10 or 10 o'clock. If you want to start taking your lecture exam then, that would be fine with me. All right, so when you come in, just be prepared to take the exam. And if you need to study, study out in the hall a little bit, and we're ready to go with that, okay? So raise your hand if you think it's a good idea to start the exam early, earlier. Yeah, it's a pretty good idea, okay? But if you need to study, of course, you can study out there. And I'm usually at school pretty early, and I open up the study room, the anatomy and physiology study room. If you want to look at models and things like that, you're welcome to do that as well. All right, so that's the schedule. Then, it's Memorial Day weekend coming up, I do believe. It's a long weekend. I don't know when I'm going to have all the practicums and lecture grades or lecture exams graded. Maybe over the weekend, but only if it rains. If it's nice weather, I probably won't be inside grading the tests and things like that. So you'll just have to wait for your final grade and your grade on the lecture exam and the practicum. Okay, that's all I know. Does anybody have a question over the schedule or how we're going to end up the class? Anything like that? But don't forget, the class is not over May 20th. It's actually over May 21st, right? Because that's the deadline for an online quiz. May 21st, that's a Thursday at 11 p.m. But it's probably a really good idea if you look at that quiz before you take the test, right? So get it done if it's not done already. You don't want to forget about that because if you have a lecture exam and a practicum, guess what? You might forget about the online quiz, right? So please take care of that well ahead of time. All right, so I'm going to put the schedule away unless I see somebody has a question. No questions, fantastic. All right, so what's the purpose of the reproductive system once again? What's the purpose of the reproductive system? Does anybody know? Raise your hand. I want to call on you, and then you can tell me. No one wants to raise their hand. Nobody knows what the function is. Oh, hi. One person. Yay. Tell us. Yes, it's to produce new and unique individuals. Yep, which introduces diversity into our population. And that's really important because there are very few things that will affect everybody, right? And one of the things is for both males and females has to do with bones. As we grow older, we lose calcium from our bodies, and that leads to a condition that you all know about as we get older. Osteoporosis. Yeah, all of our bones get weaker and brittle, and men suffer from that as well. And women, especially if you have thin bones to start with, right? The bigger and thicker your bones are, When you reach puberty, then you're a little bit more protected from osteoporosis. But everybody will lose bone density as we get older. So I'm sure you don't want fractures as you get older, because usually when somebody breaks a hip, they usually only live for maybe about another year, and that's about it. Because when somebody breaks a hip, they can't recover at home. They have to go to a nursing facility. And when you're up in your late 70s, 80s, you're away from your family and your home surroundings, you kind of just give up the will to live. So it's real important. So how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? I know that's the last thing you're thinking about right now is when you're 70 or 80 years old, but it's probably a good idea to start thinking about it. How can you protect yourself? Yes, the dreaded diet and exercise, both. Okay, so what kind of exercise? There are some exercises that are better than others. What kind of exercises? Something that stresses bones, right? Because just like when you stress a muscle, it gets bigger and stronger. If you pull on a bone, it gets bigger and stronger. So usually people say weight-bearing exercise is the best thing. But probably any kind of exercise helps. So that's exercise. What about the diet component? What do you have to have in your diet that your body can't make? Calcium, I heard calcium. Fantastic, yeah. Calcium. And, you know, if we just eat calcium, it might not enter our body. So what is the other thing that we have to have? And somebody told me it is vitamin D. All right, so vitamin D is necessary for the absorption of calcium, which is necessary for the utilization of calcium inside our body. And what other things inside your body do you need calcium for? Can anybody think of another reason? Teeth? Okay, teeth, bones, what else? I think maybe I mentioned this. Oh, muscle contraction, like your diaphragm. Calcium is necessary for breathing. This is true. And there are a couple other things, but I'm just going to mention one, and that is it has to do with the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, a synapse. That's right, calcium is necessary for synaptic transmission. So if pretend you're your body, I know you're you, but pretend you're your body taking care of everything inside your body, and you have a limited amount of calcium, where are you going to put that calcium? In your bones to make them strong, in muscles so they contract, or in your nervous system so that nerves can communicate, so that you have a brain, basically. Which place would you put them? Nervous system, that's really important. That's right, without nervous system, you can't contract muscles, right? And bone is probably the last place when you start to run out of calcium, right? So usually the reproductive system protects us from things like that, right? But not in that particular case. All right, so let's take a look at some complication of the opposite gender. We looked at the male reproductive system last time. Does anybody have any questions on male? All right, well, let's take a look at female reproductive system. The primary organ in the male, who can remember what the primary reproductive organ in the male is? Yeah, the testes. And the job of the testes was to produce sex steroid and also gametes, right? A gamete is a half-human cell. It's got half the number of chromosomes. And what a testes can produce is a pretty unique cell in terms of humans, because it's the only cell that is motile. It can swim around. So what is the thing that allows it to swim around? Yeah, it has a flagellum, right? So it's the only cell that really that expresses a flagellum. There are many that express cilia, but not a flagellum. All right, so the primary reproductive structure in the female is the ovary, which I'm showing you a nice big slide of here. All right, and we're going to look at all these other structures like vagina, cervix, uterus, fallopian tube, and ovary, right? So we're just looking at the ovary. Ovary is held in place with some ligaments, a broad ligament and an ovarian ligament. Oh, here's that broad ligament here. Here's the ovarian ligament. It's held in place, right? But other than that, it's a fairly delicate structure. And when I look at this ovary, do you see any structure inside the ovary? Do you see things in there? Yeah, I see some things in there. And what I see is a bunch of these, they almost look like a cyst. They're not a cyst, right? These are what we call primary follicles. They're on their way to becoming an oocyte, and an oocyte is a female gamete. It has half the number of chromosomes compared to the usual cell. So that's the counterpart of the male gamete, which is a sperm, counterpart to sperm. Okay, and then during a certain part of a person's life, one of these eggs can start to mature and goes through a number of different stages, and then finally it becomes what we call a graafian follicle or a mature follicle. And it's here is the oocyte surrounded by other kind of cells and even a little antrum containing fluid. And then with the proper signals, this mature oocyte can be expelled from the ovary. Right? And that process is what we call, everybody knows, ovulation. That happens right at mid-cycle. And then, here is what's left of all those cells that made up a mature follicle, and that does not degenerate right away. It becomes a very important endocrine gland. And I can see it developing over here, and then finally over here, here's a nice mature corpus luteum. Corpus luteum. So where does the corpus luteum come from? Comes from a follicle after ovulation, right? All those cells are still there. And the corpus luteum is important. We're going to take a look and see what is it's important for. But it is important because it secretes progesterone. So I see all of these developing oocytes over here. They're responsible for secreting estrogen, right? So estrogen from a developing follicle or a mature follicle, and then progesterone from a corpus luteum. Okay, so what produces a corpus luteum? What process produces a corpus luteum? I see it right here. Yeah, ovulation does, right? Ovulation does. All right, so what I see right here are primary follicles, right? And primary follicles develop prenatally, which means before birth. So a woman will have a number of these follicles, and you don't have this in your notes, so you might want to write it down. About 4 to 5 million, okay, develop. And they actually start to degenerate and go away. So right at birth, there's about the same number, but it's decreased a little bit. Right? And right at puberty, so many of those primary follicles disappear that there's only about 200,000 left. So there's a lot of variability. Maybe some women might have 1 million, right? Some might have 100,000, but it's about 180,000 at puberty. And then you see that it goes through this process of maturation, and only about 400 ever reach that pre-ovulatory stage, right, that which can ovulate a mature oocyte. And then at menopause, when a woman stops cycling, then there's usually about 1,000 of these things left. Okay. And so this is what we call oogenesis. And in a male, right, a male will produce sperm his whole lifetime. I don't even know how many. Somebody should Google that. How many sperm will a male produce? I don't really know. Billions, billions, and trillions? I don't know. Oh, 1 billion? 1 billion sperm for every oocyte. Okay. Oh, okay. Oocytes, watch out. That's all I can say. All right, so you might feel kind of bad that a male can produce sperm or gametes their whole life, but you're stuck right at birth, or females are stuck right at birth. You just have the primary oocytes that you will ever have at that point. All right, but you know what? At puberty, you have 180, and I don't know any woman anywhere that wants to have 180 offspring anyway, right? So that's more than enough to go around. All right, so just remember, the development of primary oocytes is a fetal process, and then when somebody reaches menarche, then one or two of these primary follicles starts on the journey to become a mature follicle, and usually only one makes it. Every once in a while, maybe there's two that get ovulated. I've never heard of three or four normally making it into the stage of a mature follicle. Okay, who's got a question about that? What hormone is being secreted primarily by this developing follicle? Estrogen, right. And then after ovulation, what is that important endocrine gland that develops? The corpus luteum, and the job of the corpus luteum is to secrete, if you're going to pick one, progesterone. Okay, progesterone, they're both sex steroids. Progesterone is a contraction of two words. It's a contraction for progestational hormone. Progestational hormone, progesterone. And what is gestation? That's the period of development in utero, right? That's when somebody's pregnant. So progesterone is important for maintaining pregnancy. That's primarily what it's there for, or for maintaining the uterus so that implantation can take place. All right, so what about this oocyte right here? Where can it go? Where can it swim to? Where can this oocyte swim to? Okay. Ah, some people said uterus, but you see a flagellum. No, there's no flagellum. Do you see cilia? I don't see cilia. Okay, so I got a pretty good question for you. How does it end up in the uterus? Okay. Yeah, let's go to another picture and I can describe this a little bit better. All right, and I think if I go back to this picture right here, is that picture of an ovary that we were just looking at. And when that oocyte is ovulated, I don't see it on this picture, but maybe this is it right where I have the cursor right now. Here is a fallopian tube, and it provides a pathway between this ovary and the uterus. Right? It's just a pathway, and that oocyte should make its way down through this pathway right here. And the fallopian tube has a couple components to it. It has this edge that kind of looks like it's very lacy, looks like little fingers right here, or kind of maybe ruffles. This is what we call the fimbria. And there's some smooth muscle in there, so all of these fimbria-like fingers are sweeping over the surface of the ovary all the time. And just like inside the fallopian tube, there's a special epithelium that lines this tube and aligns these fimbria, and these cells are ciliated. And what's the function of cilia once again? Motility. That's right. So all of these cilia are sweeping, and guess which way they're sweeping? Toward the uterus. That's exactly right. Remember, where else did we run into ciliated cells that were really important for sweeping? Trachea, and that was, they're important to help keep our lungs clean. All right, but in this particular case, those cilia help these oocytes make their way down through this fallopian tube. And we usually think that fertilization takes place within a fallopian tube, and then that fertilized egg, which we call an oocyte, makes its way down to the uterus, which happens under normal circumstances, right? Under normal circumstances. Okay. Well, there can be some abnormal circumstances. If anybody has, or if a woman has any form of pelvic inflammatory disease, all right. Then there can be an infection of the fallopian tube, the fimbria, and when that happens, that leaves a scar. It could be a functional scar to where the cilia stop sweeping, or it could be a physical scar that causes a blockage of the fallopian tube or a partial blockage of the fallopian tube so that when an egg is ovulated, it can't make its way all the way to the uterus. Right? And if the fimbria is scarred for whatever reason, then that egg just does what? It just floats around in what cavity is the uterus in? Pelvic cavity. Is there anything separating the pelvic cavity from the abdominal cavity? Absolutely nothing, right? So that egg can float around anywhere in there because it's not being guided by those cilia. All right? But if there is sperm in the vagina, right, they can swim through the cervical canal, indeed. They can swim through the uterus like they're supposed to, right? They swim up into the fallopian tube like everybody expects for fertilization to take place, but, right, they can swim right out of the fallopian tube through the fimbriated edge and swim around anywhere in the pelvic cavity or anywhere in the abdominal cavity, right? Because they just swim around. And if they bump into a ovulated egg, right, a mature oocyte, fertilization can take place, right, in the pelvic cavity, in the abdominal cavity, and you saw mesenteries in lab. What was one of the things that kind of stuck out when you looked at mesentery of that fetal pig in lab? What did you see when you looked at mesentery? I saw like a fan, right? Did you see that fan? And what was in that fan? What was in that fan that you saw? You saw the really clear membrane, but that allowed you to see something else in that clear membrane, which were blood vessels. That's right. So the mesenteries are highly vascular. So that fertilized egg or zygote, when it becomes a blastocyst, can implant into mesentery. Right? It can implant into the wall of the fallopian tube, maybe on the surface of some other structure, right? Maybe on the surface of the uterus. And that kind of pregnancy is very dangerous, right, for the following reason. If we look at the uterus, which is the normal location for implantation, right, what can you tell me about the wall of the uterus? Is it really thin or is it thick? Thick. That's right. And so what is the major part of the uterus right here that makes it thick? It is the myometrium, right? And the myometrium is it like cardiac muscle? No, it is smooth muscle, right? So the uterus is extremely muscular, and that will maintain pregnancy, right? If implantation takes place in a fallopian tube or mesentery, there's no smooth muscle there to maintain pregnancy, and the developing fetus rips away from wherever it had implanted, and it causes a massive hemorrhage, right? Internal massive hemorrhage. And that's very dangerous. A woman can bleed to death in a very short period of time, right? And probably in just a matter of hours, and maybe even sooner than that. So a lot faster than, say, overnight. And does anybody know what kind of pregnancy that's called? It's not in the uterus, yeah? It's called an ectopic pregnancy, right? Ectopic pregnancy just means a pregnancy at some location other than the uterus. Could be fallopian tube, right? It could be mesentery and pelvic or abdominal cavities. And now you know it's a very serious circumstance. And it used to be misdiagnosed. Frequently, sometimes, I don't know how frequent it was, but it was pretty frequent because they had to do something special in emergency rooms. A woman would come to the emergency room and have abdominal pain and pelvic pain, and there would be a workup and they couldn't find anything wrong, and it's kind of a nondescript pain. You could get pain there if you eat something strange or pull a muscle or any of that kind of stuff. And so sometimes the advice was, oh, well, I'll tell you what, go home, and if you still have that pain in the morning, come back and we'll look a little bit further. And you might want to take an aspirin or something to kind of quiet the pain down so that you can sleep overnight. And many times a woman would never make it back to the emergency room. They would bleed to death because what they had was an ectopic pregnancy. So what they used to do in emergency rooms, until everybody became familiar with this condition, they would hang a sign in the emergency room, a big sign. And guess what that big sign said? Think ectopic. All right? So when do you have to think ectopic? When I would go into the emergency room?
No.
No, right, because I can't be pregnant, so I can't have an ectopic pregnancy. Okay, so some things run through a person's mind trying to help women out in that condition. You say, well, is this person in their childbearing years? Are they in that age group? Okay, and number two, are they sexually active? That would be important to know. If you're not sexually active, can't have ectopic pregnancy, right? And then the third thing would be what I mentioned right when we started discussing this. You have a history of any sort of pelvic inflammatory disease. That could be a sexually transmitted disease or maybe any other kind of infectious process, right? It doesn't have to be just sexually transmitted disease, which causes scarring. And if that's the case, then you have to be really serious, measure some endocrine levels, maybe do some ultrasound imaging, right, to see what's happening in there. All right, so that's a really serious condition, and ER physicians now are really aware and take it very seriously too. And if you have a friend that's pregnant and experiencing those kind of symptoms, then you have to be really supportive and get her to an emergency room as well, because it could be life-threatening. And you know what? That could be really difficult to do, because most women I know would rather die than give up a pregnancy. Right, but it's too late at that point in time. They just have to take that seriously. So try to help them out, get them to an ER for some proper diagnosis. All right, so that's the fallopian tube. Fallopian tube's got some other pieces. This narrowing, narrowing is what we call an isthmus. And then here, a little bit of an enlarged area, kind of looks like a little vial. That's the ampule, right? And then the infundibulum is what's connected to the fimbria. So you get fimbria, infundibulum, right? We ran into infundibulum before. That was a connection between the hypothalamus and pituitary gland. Well, this is the connection between the fimbria and the rest, the remainder of the fallopian tube. And this narrowing right here is what we call the isthmus of the fallopian tube. Now in lab, let's see, what in lab, what do we call this? I think maybe they're called uterine tubes, right? Uterine tubes, fallopian tubes are exactly the same thing. Okay. Okay, so this fallopian tube, especially when I look at the infundibulum and the fimbriated edge, it reminds me of a musical instrument. Okay, what kind of musical instrument? I can hear music right now. What kind of music? Yeah, trumpet. Did I mention this last time? Oh, I did. Okay, well, never mind. Okay, except, for instance, when somebody has a scar of a fallopian tube, sometimes it fills up with fluid, and you would like to know how much at risk this person is or why they might be infertile. Right, so it kind of fills up, kind of maybe looks like a sausage or something right here. And that kind of picture of the uterus and fallopian tube is called a hysterosalpingogram. So remember, salpinx is a fallopian tube. Salpinx means trumpet. Hystero refers to the uterus. So a hysterosalpingogram is a picture of fallopian tube and uterus together, just to see what the structure is, if it's filled with fluid. Okay. Or if it's just normal size, which means then that the fallopian tube is patent, which means it's what? It's open. Things can flow through it. Okay. Has anybody ever heard of a hysterosalpingogram before? Probably not. A lot of people get them, but it's a really weird term. And since you're taking anatomy, if you hear that really weird term, I want you to be able to say, oh, yeah, I heard of that someplace in time, and not just go, I never heard of that. That sounds really weird. But it's not weird. Okay. All right, so that's something about the fallopian tube. And so let me scroll down just a little bit. There are a couple ligaments that are really important. All right, so here is that ovarian ligament between the body of the uterus and the ovary, helps stabilize it. All right, then there's a round ligament that goes to the body wall from to the uterus that helps stabilize the uterus. And both of these ligaments are embedded in another one that's a broad, flat sheath. And that's called the broad ligament, right? And the broad ligament attaches, right, to the uterus, a fallopian tube, ovary, the other ligaments, and that just stabilizes everything up against the posterior pelvic wall. Let's see if I missed anything. Ah, okay, here's something interesting. What is this most superior part of a uterus that is kind of dome-shaped? Okay. And it's above the opening of the fallopian tubes. It is the fundus of the uterus. Where did you run into a fundus before? The stomach, right? And remember, what did I say students have a really hard time with sometimes? They confuse the fundus in the stomach with the cardiac region, right? But just remember that the most superior part of the uterus and the stomach is called the fundic region, or fundus, okay, and you'll be in really good shape. All right, just like the heart, the uterus has a number of different layers. There's a layer on the inside that's called the endometrium. That's a really important layer because it changes a whole bunch of times. And the big strong muscle right here is the myometrium, right? And then the outer layer is called the perimetrium, right? So that's mostly just connective tissue. All right, so endometrium, myometrium, and perimetrium. The most inferior part of the uterus is what we call the cervix. So here's the cervix in cross-section, right, and then here is the canal that allows communication between the vagina and the lumen, or the body of the uterus, right? We call that the cervical canal because here is the cervix. And openings from the uterus to the cervical canal is called the internal os. The opening from the vagina into the cervix is called the external os. All right, and kind of just like the fundus of the uterus, the cervix also has a domed shape to it. Right? It has a nice dome shape. And these indentations where the cervix joins with the vagina, these indentations here are called fornices, right? So I see two lateral fornices, but they're a complete circle that go all the way around the dome of the cervix. So there's an anterior fornix, a posterior fornix, as well as these lateral fornices, and of course there's fornices in between all those particular points because it's a complete circle. All right, and then here we have the vagina, and it's got some smooth muscle as well, right? So that just accepts the male penis during copulation and sperm, right, for procreation, and then the sperm, right, hopefully have those motility agents and they start swimming wherever they want to go. Okay, well, I have a question. Here's a question. I got a good question for you. Is cancer a sexually transmitted disease? Can you get cancer from another person? I hear no. I hear a lot of no's. So guess what? You know what? I'm really glad I brought it up. Really glad. Because not many people talk about it quite so bluntly like I do. But you know what? There's probably... I got to do a Wikipedia on this. I don't know what the current number is. Let's say 5,000 women in the United States die of cervical cancer every year. All right, so here is the cancer, here is the cervix, and this is where cancer develops. And there can be a couple reasons why somebody can get cervical cancer. Maybe there's a predisposition in the family, or if their mom took certain drugs during pregnancy, the cervix is a little bit more prone to become cancerous. But the most common cause for cancer of the cervix is a viral infection called human papillomavirus, HPV. Human papillomavirus has, right now, I think we know over 100 different strains of human papillomavirus. Four of those strains that we know about can actually infect the cervix and cause it to become cancerous. Right? So, I don't know, you can make up your own mind and think of whether or not cancer is a sexually transmitted disease or not. Yeah, question? Okay. Well, what can you do for a lot of infections that you might get later on in life? What can you do to protect yourself from infections? Yeah, vaccine. Right, and so there is a vaccine, maybe two, that have been approved. One is called Gardasil. Is that still on the market? I hope so. Gardasil. I don't know what the name of the other one is. Okay, can develop some immunity for the woman against human papillomavirus, and if you prevent the infection, guess what you prevent? Cancer. Right. So I don't know. Does it sound like cancer is a sexually transmitted disease? Because you get human papillomavirus from intimate contact with a male partner. That's how one gets human papillomavirus. So I just kind of think of cancer, sure, under those circumstances could be a sexually transmitted disease. All right, the unfortunate and strange thing about that is that as far as we know right now, there are no symptoms for a male when they're a carrier for human papillomavirus. So they have no idea if they're carrying human papillomavirus, but the woman can later on in life. Fortunately, or actually it is fortunate, but it's sad that so many women die of cervical cancer because it's 100% preventable, right? It's preventable with abstinence, and of course if somebody uses a condom and it doesn't break, then that prevents human papillomavirus infection. And the other thing that it's a shame so many women die of is that it's easily detected, and if it's detected early, it's 100% curable. So here is something that's 100% preventable, easily detected, and 100% curable. Why do so many women get cervical cancer and die? Right? So how can you protect yourself from cervical cancer if, right now in your life, what can somebody do right now? They can get checked. Their cervix can be checked and diagnosed for dysplastic cells or cancerous cells, and then they can be treated. Really, at least I think it's an easy procedure. Okay, and what's that procedure called where the cervix is looked at, the cells in the cervix are looked at? It's called a pap smear, right? Pap smear? Wow. Okay, nobody yelled it out. I think everybody in here, at least females, should be getting a pap smear at least once a year. Okay? And if cancer is or some abnormal cells are seen on the cervix with a little cryoablation procedure, those cells can be destroyed and then they never progress into the cancerous stage. Right? And if you can ever avoid cancer, that's a really good thing. Would you agree? Yeah, I certainly would agree with that. Okay, and that's a really easy procedure, and it takes years for cervical cancer to develop. Maybe 10 years, 15, maybe 20 years down the line. So if you develop cervical cancer and you know it's a sexually transmitted disease and you've been married for 10 years, right, and then all of a sudden you get this sexually transmitted disease, that may or may not be from your husband, right, because it has a really long incubation time. But that also means that it can be detected very easily. You have a long time to detect it. Be careful with this cervix right here. And we think that the younger the cervix is, the more sensitive it is for HPV infection. Right? So a teenager is much more susceptible for that infection than a woman in her 40s or 50s. Okay, any questions on that? No? You're good with that? Let's see, what else do I have to mention about this particular figure? I think that's pretty much about it, because we've talked about that ovary already. Okay, the cervix. All right, we've got a couple more pictures. Oh, here is that ovary. Talked about that. Oh, I'll tell you what, let me put this away and just take a look. Ah, here's another exam figure, right? So that was kind of a coronal view of the female reproductive tract that we looked at. And here's a nice sagittal view. And here I can see the vagina, and then here the anterior posterior fornix around the cervix, cervical canal, right? And then the lumen of the uterus, and then kind of off to the side I can see the salpinx with the fimbriated edge and ovary, and I can see some ligaments as well. Okay. And the vagina, here's the orifice of the vagina. It opens up into a little place that we call the vestibule. Some of the margins of the vestibule are the labia minorum and majorum. And also this Bartholin's gland and the clitoris all kind of make up the vestibule. And that kind of protects the reproductive tract from infection. Right? And then the other thing I see kind of just grayed out a little bit is the urinary system. So here's the urinary bladder underneath the uterus, and then here's the connection between the urinary bladder and the outside world, which is the urethra. So this is a really nice modern system, if you know anything about other kinds of mammals, because the urinary system never joins the reproductive system. In other mammals, that certainly is the case, right? The urethra can join the vagina, probably the other way around. Vagina can join the urethra, and then it becomes a urogenital sinus, right? And then you have the orifice right here. But in humans, it's always separated, and that reduces what? Pelvic inflammatory disease, which does what? It helps a woman get pregnant and maintain pregnancy. So in an evolutionary sense, it's a very good thing to have. What else should I say about this? Yes. It secretes mucus, okay? And so mucus is important for lubrication, but probably also something else that's even more important, which I mentioned for the bulbourethral gland. Mucus is a protein, which is a buffer, right? It helps neutralize acid. All right, so a nice acidic environment of the vestibule, the urethra, and vagina also will inhibit bacterial growth, so it's a really good thing, but it will also inhibit sperm motility. All right, so after copulation or during copulations, it's important to have that buffer there so that those sperm maintain motility. All right, so it's kind of good for two reasons. Good, that was a good question. So nice to know something about that mucus. Right, it's a good buffer because it's a protein. All right. Anybody got a question on this thing right here? All right. Your textbook has a couple interesting pictures, and they're put together in kind of a strange way. I'm going to show you some of these pictures. Okay. I see something right here. All right. When you look at this picture, what do you see? I see a bunch of follicles developing from a primary follicle, right? Secondary vesicular follicle, right? And then it becomes a mature follicle or Graafian follicle, and then ovulation. And then what happens to this follicle after ovulation? It becomes the corpus luteum, right? And if implantation does not take place, then the corpus luteum degenerates, and a woman can start a new cycle. So this is just a picture of what a follicle looks like during over time. And this time right here is a 28-day period, or typically what we think of female menstrual cycle is. All right, but this is happening not in the uterus, but in an ovary. All right, so here is a picture that shows a follicle. And it names some of these different pieces right here, different phases of ovulation. And then here is a profile of a couple important hormones, estrogen and progesterone, during the menstrual cycle, 28-day cycle. It's on its own slide. So this is, what, plasma level of these two particular hormones. And you should realize that that corresponds to what we just looked at with the follicles. And then here is something plotted out or drawn out within the same period of time, one menstrual cycle. And this represents the inner lining of the uterus. What's that inner lining called? The endometrium. Nice. All right, so here is the functional part of the endometrium. Here's the basal layer. And you can see that the endometrium changes shape quite a bit as well during the menstrual cycle. All right, so here I see that the endometrium is pretty thin, and it gets thicker and thicker and thicker. So what's happening during this stage right here where the endometrium starts to grow and get thicker? Okay. It's a form of asexual reproduction. Sort of. It's almost kind of ironic that we're talking about all these structures for sexual reproduction, but if the basis is asexual reproduction, and what's happening here, somebody told me, is you start with one cell, you end up with two. Then you get two, end up with exactly the same four. What's that called? That was mitosis, right? So here is an important growth phase. It's driven by mitosis, right? And it's called the proliferative phase. So if a tissue is proliferating, what is it doing? It is growing. Okay, and, you know, that can be a really serious concern if there is uncontrolled growth in somebody's body. Right here it's controlled because the endometrium eventually degenerates and is lost from the female. Okay, but if a tissue starts to grow and grow and grow and grow and never degenerates, what do we call that? Well, certainly it's a tumor. That's a tumor of some kind, right? If it's in your brain, that's bad because it can push your brain away, right? But sometimes those cells from a tumor can break off and go to another part of your body, and another tumor can start growing. And that is what we call cancer. Right? So I'm always kind of concerned when I see tissue proliferating. We want to make sure that it has good control so that it just doesn't keep growing and growing and growing. And under normal circumstances, what happens to this endometrium? It regresses. Right? So that's another picture that happens, what, same 28-day cycle as the previous two that I looked at. And then there's one more, this one right here. Here are some, remember we looked at progesterone and estrogen, but here are a couple other hormones that are important. Luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, same 28-day cycle. So these pictures in your textbook I find just a little confusing because they're all separate, and what would be really nice is if they were all put together on one picture. Your book doesn't do that. Maybe I'll give it to you, but I'm going to show it right now because it's going to help you answer some of those questions at the end of the chapter. And I like those questions at the end of the chapter because I can put them on your lecture exam. All right, so what happens when we put all of these things together? I had it right, oh, Bio 231, had it right here. Okay, let's look at this. And maybe I'll put this on two slides. Ooh, I might have to, how about if I, what does that PDF look like? I have a PDF. Can I show it all easily? Almost, but I can shrink it down a little bit. There, perfect. Let me go to a different kind of projection so that both sides of the class can see it. Let's do one and one. All right, so here is a really pretty picture. It looks complicated, but we kind of talked about it already. Right, so what is the horizontal axis? It is time, right, and it's for 28 days, which is a typical menstrual cycle. And what do we see during this period of time? We see changes in the uterus, namely, what part of the uterus? The endometrium. Okay, we see changes of follicles, right? And where are these follicles at? The ovary, right? So here is a really nice illustration of what's happening in an ovary, what's happening in a uterus. And then, but more importantly, what do we see justified with it? We see ovulation and we see hormones, right? Hormones that are controlling all of these things, right? And so that's the most important thing. We don't want this thing just to go crazy on its own. We certainly want it under control. And the four hormones are follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, and estrogen and progesterone. Okay, where does estrogen and progesterone come from? It's the same organ. It comes from the ovaries. Estrogen and progesterone from ovaries, really nice. FSH and LH come from the same gland as well. And does anybody remember from, it is the pituitary gland, right? But more importantly, what pituitary gland? The anterior pituitary, right? And how are the hormones from the anterior pituitary signaled to be released? The hypothalamus controls it, right? And remember, does anybody remember what the hypothalamus secretes to let the anterior pituitary know what to do? Yeah, gonadotropin something. Remember, there are releasing hormones or releasing factors from the hypothalamus. Both FSH and LH are gonadotropins, and so we would just call that what? A gonadotropin releasing hormone from the hypothalamus. But typically, we just write capital G, little n, RH, GnRH from the hypothalamus, okay, to the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary is going to release FSH and LH. And in the female, what's the target tissue for FSH and LH? There might be many, but here I see one. It is the ovary, right? So the ovary has receptors for FSH and LH. Otherwise, the ovary wouldn't have any idea that they're floating around, right? You got to have a receptor in order to perceive something. Like, in order to see light, what do you need? A photoreceptor, right? So the ovary has to have FSH and LH receptors. Okay. So initially, I see FSH fairly high, and then I see a down arrow. FSH stands for follicle-stimulating hormone. So what is it going to stimulate? A follicle. And what did we learn about follicles? That they mature over the first part of the menstrual cycle. And actually what we're looking at right here, since it's the ovary, we could call this the ovarian cycle because this is what's happening in the ovary. So FSH is primarily responsible for maturation of a follicle. And that's the first half of the cycle. And then LH goes through this big surge. I see this big peak right here, right at mid-cycle. That's responsible for causing, what do we have here? Ovulation, right? Luteinizing hormone, because what was the structure that comes after ovulation from a mature follicle? That was the corpus luteum, right? So that's why this is called luteinizing hormone, because it helps create a corpus luteum. So if you had to pick one hormone that causes ovulation, would you say estrogen, progesterone, FSH, or LH? Which is the biggest one that changes the most? It is LH. That's right. So LH is important for ovulation. All right. And so now we have the corpus luteum. LH also helps maintain the corpus luteum just a little bit, but not too much. If implantation takes place, right, then these levels pretty much remain constant. All right. So estrogen. Here I see estrogen, and I see it increasing over the menstrual cycle. Estrogen comes from the ovary, but you should probably know the particular part of the ovary, right? And what is growing during this part? The follicle is growing, right? So a maturing follicle secretes estrogen, and this is the first part of the menstrual cycle. And also, so, right, the follicle secretes estrogen, and what does that cause? It causes proliferation, right, of the endometrium, proliferation. And sometimes if a woman has breast cancer, right, they analyze the cancer in the breast to see if it has estrogen receptors, right, because then that estrogen from the ovary will be promoting that kind of cancer of the breast. And then there's different ways you want to treat that kind of syndrome. Right? So there are estrogen receptors. In this particular case, where are the estrogen receptors? In the uterus, yeah, in the uterus, right? And so this estrogen is causing the endometrium to grow. We call that proliferation. And where does this estrogen come from? It comes from the ovary, and in particular, the maturing follicles. And how does this maturing follicle know to mature? What's controlling it? FSH from what gland? The anterior pituitary. And the anterior pituitary can't always act on its own. It's listening for a signal from the hypothalamus. That's right. So it's a big chain of control mechanisms right there. GnRH from the hypothalamus, right, controls the release of FSH from the anterior pituitary, causes this follicle to grow, and it secretes estrogen. Estrogen then goes to a distant location, namely the uterus, that has estrogen receptors, and it causes the endometrium to grow, right, during this part of the menstrual cycle. All right, after ovulation, right, look what happens to estrogen. It decreases, because what's going away? The follicle has gone away, and what has replaced it? The corpus luteum. And look at what happens to another hormone. As soon as the corpus luteum appears and starts to grow, what's another hormone that is being produced? Progesterone, right? So progesterone comes from the corpus luteum. Estrogen comes from the developing follicle. And as the follicle gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it can secrete more estrogen. As the corpus luteum gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it can secrete more progesterone. Well, the uterus not only has estrogen receptors, but it has progesterone receptors as well. So what's the effect of progesterone? And I can see estrogen hasn't gone away. So in combination, what's happening? That puts the final growing touches on the endometrium. And as estrogen is increasing, then it activates some glands in the endometrium. And I can't tell you the name of what it secretes, what these glands secrete. As a matter of fact, I don't know if anybody really knows what it is just yet. Okay? And maybe we don't really know what the function is yet. If we can't name it, we probably don't know what the function is. But you could take a wild guess. What do you think these glands in a mature endometrium ready for implantation, what is it there? What do these glands secrete? What might be the function of some of these things? It is to enhance implantation. Would be my hypothesis, right? Hypothesis is something you don't know, but something you can guess about, right? So that's not a theory yet. So here I can see some of these glands. I see, what, a lot more blood vessels. I see angiogenesis. Angio is a blood vessel. Genesis is the making of something, right? So progesterone is important for putting the final maturation touches on the endometrium. And then as progesterone goes away, look what happens to the endometrium. Starts to regress, right? And then it's shed from the body with this mild period of hemorrhage, and then the cycle can start all over once again. All right, so this is what happens During pregnancy or without pregnancy? Yeah, without pregnancy. Right. And maybe I'll go over that, all those steps one more time, but you're probably interested, what would happen here during pregnancy? Say if there is implantation, maybe day 25, right here. We don't want the endometrium to degenerate, we want to maintain it. Or, right, evolutionarily speaking, right, it would be good for that implantation, for the endometrium to stay nice and mature and healthy. And what hormone is responsible for maintaining this endometrium? Progesterone. But here it's coming from this corpus luteum. Normally the corpus luteum disappears. So the corpus luteum has to receive a signal saying, hey, there's implantation. Right? Don't go away. Don't regress. Right? So that developing fetus secretes a hormone that goes back to the ovary, namely the corpus luteum, and it maintains the health of the corpus luteum so that it can secrete progesterone. Right? So these two things work together to maintain pregnancy. And that hormone is what somebody measures in a pregnancy test that you can do at home as well. And I bet no one has ever heard of what that hormone is, but maybe you've used it a whole bunch already. I'm not sure. So you should probably know what the name is. Do you want to know what the name is? It's not on this particular slide. It's called human chorionic gonadotropin, which is way too much to say. Otherwise, it's known as little h, right, standing for, that's you, human, right? And then chorionic is a C, gonadotropin is a G, and that hormone is what we call HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin. Anybody remember where HCG comes from? The implanted, yeah, the fetus as it's developing. It actually is coming from the chorion, which is a part of the placenta. Okay, it secretes it, and what tissue has HCG receptor? Yeah, okay, it is the ovary, and in particular, it's the corpus luteum. Right, and that signals the corpus luteum to stick around and actually to grow and increase levels of progesterone. Okay, and that happens for the first maybe 10 weeks of pregnancy. And then the placenta is big enough to take over the job, and the placenta then starts to secrete progesterone and estrogen, and then the corpus luteum is no longer needed, right, after a bunch of weeks, like maybe about 10 weeks. All right, so that's nice control of this corpus luteum. So what maintains, what hormone maintains the endometrium for pregnancy and implantation? If you had to pick one hormone, what would you pick? Yeah, progesterone. And what is its name? Progestational hormone, right? Progestational hormone is progesterone. Okay, so here is a really nice slide that links all of these hormones together. And so for the test coming up on Wednesday, right, you should know these two areas, right, a follicle in an ovary, the endometrium in a uterus, and what hormone causes, and so here's one thing you should know, what hormone causes a follicle to develop? That causes a follicle to develop? It's a hormone from the pituitary, anterior pituitary, FSH, right? And then what hormone, if you had to pick one, what hormone causes ovulation? Yeah, LH, right? So FSH causes maturation of a follicle. LH causes ovulation. What hormone causes proliferation in the uterus to get ready for implantation and pregnancy? If you had to pick just one. Estrogen, right? And then when the endometrium becomes mature and competent, right? So it can receive an implantation or it can accept implantation, there should be one hormone on your mind, right, that's mostly responsible for that. Just pick one. Progesterone. Right? So those could be some questions that you might have to match up. Does anybody know if there's an end of chapter question that goes over that stuff? Okay. All right, but you know how you do in this class if you cram overnight. It's tough, right? So you should probably look at some of those things. All right, so your book has these diagrams, but it doesn't link them together in this nice fashion. And it probably talks about HCG, okay, but HCG is not on here. Okay. And with that, I think I'm done. I don't have any other interesting things to say. You guys probably have a lot of really interesting questions. Oh, maybe I have something interesting to say. Birth control pills. Does anybody know how a birth control pill works? What's in a birth control pill? Yeah, hormones, for sure. Okay. Well, in this particular case, let's forget about birth control pill. Let's just look at this particular case right here. We see increasing estrogen. And remember, that's due to FSH from the pituitary. That's due to GnRH from the hypothalamus. So what maintains estrogen at the proper level is that the hypothalamus has receptors. It knows how much estrogen is being produced. And if there's too much, then it stops the release of GnRH, right? And then estrogen kind of goes back down to its normal level. If it's not high enough, the hypothalamus will secrete more GnRH. So the hypothalamus knows what the levels of estrogen and progesterone are and can maintain the proper level, right, to maintain this particular cycle. Well, what does a birth control pill control have? It has estrogen and progesterone. And what part of the brain knows the levels of estrogen and progesterone in somebody's body? The hypothalamus. So when you take estrogen and progesterone, the hypothalamus thinks, oh, wow, right? That ovary is doing its job just fine. I don't need to secrete a lot of GnRH to stimulate the ovary, right? So the hypothalamus, when you're taking a lot of estrogen and progesterone, it stops the signal from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary, which is what, GnRH. So what happens to these anterior pituitary hormones when you're taking high levels of estrogen and progesterone? They disappear. Right, so if FSH and LH are very low because you're taking all of these estrogens and progesterones right here, what process is stopped if there's no FSH being released from the anterior pituitary? Yeah, there's no follicles that are developing, which will do what for fertilization? Well, nothing, right? There won't be ovulation taking place, and so no ovulation, no fertilization. That's a really good birth control pill. Okay. And a woman will take different amounts of estrogen and progesterone. There's different kinds of pills out there. And usually, right at the end of a normal menstrual cycle, what do you think should happen to progesterone and estrogen just to maintain the proper cycling of the uterus? The pill should decrease in those particular hormones, right? So that somebody will still have a menstrual period. Okay. Who's got a question about that? Estrogen and progesterone go back to the hypothalamus and it stops the secretion of FSH from the anterior pituitary, and so a follicle will not develop. That's a nice birth control pill. Yeah. Those primary follicles? I don't know if anybody knows. Somebody probably knows. I think, what did we say, right at menopause, there are about 400 left under normal circumstances. Is that what I had? I think it was about like that. If somebody prevents the maturation of those follicles, they probably have more, right, by the time they go into menopause. And that's sort of interesting, because what some people have noticed is that the number of follicles that you have remaining right at adolescence will determine whether you go through early menopause or late menopause. Right, women with a lot of primary follicles, we think, have menopause later in life. Women with fewer primary follicles will experience menopause, which is what, the cessation of cycling, earlier in life. So if you're taking birth control pills and you still have hundreds and hundreds of primary follicles, that might be a way to manipulate the onset of menopause. I don't know if anybody's ever published anything like that, but that could be interesting to look at. Does anybody have any experience with that in family at all? Probably, maybe the birth control pill hasn't been around long enough really to know. Somebody might know that. Okay. So that is sort of ironic, because if you're taking birth control pills to prevent pregnancy, it's going to what, elongate that period of time that you could become pregnant. That's sort of, I find that kind of ironic. Okay. Okay. All right, so sign-in sheet was going around. Next time, I'm going to be here hopefully early so that you can start the test early. I would guess for sure 10 o'clock if the room is not being used by another class, and I don't think it is. And it might even be earlier, depending how fast everybody is with that practicum. And the Wednesday class does not have to take a quiz, so I'll get down here fast. All right, nice having you guys as students.